preparing lessons, I always pray that the Spirit will speak to your hearts, despite what I'm saying, and you will grow closer to God. For those of you who were in the class earlier, you know that we're going to be talking about Joseph, and you heard the reading earlier. And today, for those of you who weren't there, we're going to start a new series when I come to visit you, Lord willing. And I've entitled this series, Joseph, a Man of Principle. And significantly, this is not just his principle, but God's principle. Joseph's story is one in which the hand of God is not front and center. Rather, it's unseen but constantly acting to bring his plan, that's God's plan, for his people to life through Joseph. There's several themes that come through Joseph's story, and I hope over the next few months we'll engage and examine those, that we might also be people of principle. Themes like loss and restoration, envy and rivalry, family dynamics, and perhaps most importantly, wisdom and forgiveness. Joseph's is the story of God's wisdom, love, and forgiveness, and how this righteous man wove them into his life so that he was not a victim, rather a victor. I'm going to give away the most important idea right now, day one, and I'm going to keep coming back to that. The key verse in his story is found in Genesis chapter 50, verse 20. It's going to take us some time to get through the whole story to get there. But that's where we find the understanding and faith that are at the heart of Joseph's success. So I see some of you flipping to that, and that's good. Genesis chapter 50 and verse 20, as recorded by the NIV, reads this way. You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. Hold on to that thought as we ride Joseph's highs and lows and see him model trust in God with confidence. If we can reframe our thinking to this humble and positive attitude, we can be powerful warriors in the kingdom, no matter what life throws at us. If you want to turn back to Genesis chapter 37, we'll pick up there. Our reading today began with a key statement about Joseph's life. His father, Israel, or Jacob, loved him more than any of his other children. This simple statement is loaded with the dynamite that will tear his family apart. So we need to understand some of the backstory. It all begins with young and what we might say is foolish love. Jacob was smitten by Rachel the first time he saw her, so much so that he indentured himself for 7 years to have her as a bride. And after 7 years of manual labor, this Jacob, who was a trickster at heart, was outdone at his own game when Laban switched his daughters, and Jacob found himself married to Leah. He protested, as we might expect, and Rachel was also given to him, but for another 7 years' labor. Leah bore children, but Rachel was barren. which caused even more contention between the women. Then they brought concubines into this arms race that saw these two women competing for Jacob's affection through the delivery of more and more children. But Jacob's abiding love was Rachel. So when she had a son in his old age, Joseph became the absolute favorite. When Rachel died in bringing a second son, Benjamin, into the world, those two boys were elevated above all the rest, and apparently Joseph especially. When we read earlier, we joined the story in flight. Let's go back to verse 2, and we'll see how it adds even more depth to what we are beginning to see as deep sibling rivalry. Genesis chapter 37, verse 2 says, Joseph, a young man of 17. Okay, so Joseph was a mere young man of 17, just at that awkward stage of becoming a man physically, but lacking the maturity to handle it. And if you've ever had a 17-year-old thinking the world is there to serve them and give them all their desires, common sense is just not a teenage long suit. No offense to the teenagers in the crowd, okay? But you got a lot of life to live to really understand maturity. Our author goes on. Joseph was tending the flocks with his brothers, the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and he brought their father a bad report about them. Now his immaturity plays out. Joseph brings back a bad report about some of his half-brothers. If Joseph is going to go down in the biblical record as a man of wisdom, he has a long way to go. His dad already favors him. The brothers already won't speak to him because Israel plays favorites. Now he's ratted out his brothers for sloughing off. This is hardly the way to win friends and influence these brothers. And now to this cauldron ready to boil, we add Israel's next action. He can't help but show his bias to this son who was so long in coming, whose mother was the love of his youth and was now gone. And I think we can empathize with his feelings, but we have the benefit of objectivity that we can hold up a stop sign and say, Israel, you're making a mistake. You're making things so much worse. You can't treat your sons with different affection. It's going to lead to disaster. But of course, our vantage nearly four millennia later is hindsight. What we do read in the narrative is that Israel, in loving the son of his old age more than any of the others, gifted him with what the NIV calls an ornate robe. The footnote in the NIV tells us that this word's meaning is obscure, and as our reading today said, traditionally it was a coat of many colors. To some Bible scholars, a robe with long sleeves. The point is, Joseph had one and the others didn't. It was special compared to their shepherd's togs. Their reaction was completely predictable. They hated him. They were envious of his favored position. And that green-eyed monster meant they could not even speak a kind word to Joseph. At this point, Joseph has a dream. Dreams are going to figure prominently into Joseph's story. Dreams were seen by people of that time as messages from the gods. In fact, today, many people still believe that dreams are a glimpse into the spiritual world. But without God to guide their interpretation, they open themselves to other anti-God forces or our own designs, which can make them dangerous. And that's why the Bible is very clear about spiritualism. and staying away from it. But Joseph's dream was pretty clear to his brothers and to us. They were working to dry grain in the field and raking sheaves. You don't see those much in the field unless you go to Waterloo region, the north part. You'll still see sheaves if you want to see those. His sheaf stood up while those of his brothers bowed down to honor his. And as I said, they got the message. They want to know just what makes him think they will bow down to him. Our author says they hated him all the more. Now he was piling superiority into the conflict. The ethics of the time were built on respect for elders. This teenager had the audacity to suppose that his older brothers would bow down and serve him. No wonder they got even more angry. And at this point, Joseph has another dream. This time, the sun and moon now join 11 stars bowing down to Joseph. He tells the brothers. At this point, I'm left thinking, Joseph, shouldn't you play this just a little lower key? Are you intentionally trying to antagonize them? Are you oblivious? I think Joseph just has to share what he's seen. After all, he now tells it to his incredulous father. Will your mother and I and your brothers actually come and bow down on the ground before you? His brothers continue in their jealousy, but we're told that Israel ponders this, perhaps because he himself has seen visions from heaven. The brothers leave to pasture sheep in another part of the country that's more fertile, near Shechem. And this time Joseph is not with them. He's sent by his father to ensure the well-being of his brothers. Neither father nor son seems to be concerned about any animosity of the brothers. In fact, when told of Israel's plan, Joseph responds with, "Here I am," the same idiom that Abraham offers to God when God calls upon him to test his faith with the son of his promise. It's the same term that Isaiah uses when God calls, "Whom shall I send, and who will go for us?" It's an emphatic, positive response. Joseph is ready to go. How he loves his father back. But the trip itself is hardly insignificant. Joseph will have to travel 80 kilometers by the high country wilderness road. Again, for those of you with a 17-year-old, how likely would you be to let them set off on foot to make a journey of 80 kilometers through the wilderness? I see the head shaking. When he arrives at his destination, Joseph does not find his brothers, but instead he's found wandering in the fields looking for them by a man. Remarkably, this man has information about the brothers, that they've moved on to Dothan, another 25 kilometers to the north. As Joseph approaches the brothers when he finally gets there, they see him in the distance, and we're told that then and there they conspire to kill him. Here comes that dreamer. Not understanding how Joseph thinks, but raging because he gets their father's affection, their solution is simply to eliminate him. We can just kill him and tell Dad he was killed by a wild animal. Reuben is the eldest, and as such, he's the protector of all, including the youngest. He resists any idea that they should do this. He cites the Torah, that no one can shed the blood of another. He's not, however, it turns out, averse to maltreatment. "Go ahead and throw him in this pit," he says to the others. Now, our author does let us know that he intended to go back later and rescue him. Perhaps he had in mind to send him back to his father and defuse the situation. And now we see two iconic images that we'll be through with Joseph throughout his life. They always appear as portents of a change in Joseph's fortunes. First, we see that clothing speaks of his role and status. His beautiful robe, the symbol of his father's love, is torn off as he is about to be torn away from that father. And the second image follows quickly on his heels. That is the pit into which he is thrown. The descent into a pit can be understood as a place where Joseph paradoxically receives both condemnation and salvation, says Yi Wu Feng. And we will see this cycle repeat. This day, Joseph is subjected to brutal violence. He's ostracized, left to starve, all at the hands of brothers who go off to have dinner. This day is a black day for Joseph as he is sold as a slave. The brothers look up and they spy a caravan, and Judah has an idea. We can make money off of this. Dead, he's worth nothing, but we can sell him to these traders. This way, we will have not harmed him, Judah argues. Now, as we assess this, they may not have spilled his blood, but they've certainly broken faith and betrayed him with criminal actions. They don't seem to have any remorse, with the possible exception of Reuben. And much later, we're going to see Judah himself. Joseph is sold for 20 pieces of silver to another of Abraham's descendants. He's taken to Egypt. When Reuben comes back to the pit, the boy has vanished. Reuben tears his clothes in grief. He speaks of Joseph as the boy. Reuben, by this time, is a middle-aged man, and he was supposed to be the protector of his younger brother, but he has failed. He cries out, "Where can I turn now?" Joseph is not the only one who's lost. Reuben is distraught and directionless. How can he deal with his failure? How can he stand in front of his father? We can surmise that he was not involved in this plot to sell Joseph, and now he stands a broken man. Meanwhile, the others conspire, and they stain Joseph's beautiful robe with blood. If the robe was brightly colored, now it is dominated by the red-black of dried blood. They present it to Israel. They don't even acknowledge Joseph as a brother. He's Israel's son. "We found this. Examine it to see if it's your son's." And their ruse is perfect. Israel assumes exactly what they wanted. In the wilds, Joseph must have been attacked and devoured by an animal. He's been torn to pieces. I imagine they must have shredded the robe as well to incite this kind of a conclusion. And we're told that all of his sons and daughters could not console him. As if to remind of his loss, the author reverts to calling him Jacob. Israel means he who contends with God. He's spent. "I will go down to Sheol in mourning," he says. His way, his fire, is gone. Torn clothes and sackcloth outwardly manifest the overwhelming sorrow he tells us that he will live with to the end of his days. And in a single, masterful sentence, Moses tells us that Joseph was sold to one of Pharaoh's officials, leaving us to wonder, what will happen to him? So what are our takeaways from this? After all, I hope we think that it's unlikely that our family will throw us into a cistern or sell us to a motorcycle gang. But family dynamics is a lesson for us. The situation could not have happened unless Jacob had played favorites. Certainly all of our kids are different, and they need to be loved in different ways, but they need to be loved with equal strength and equal recognition. There's a reminder for us about the folly of youth, and perhaps the folly of elders. And there's a lesson for us from Reuben's actions. While they seem to be honorable, in the end they are futile and thwarted. Where responsibility is concerned, the clandestine way is ripe for failure. Responsible action involves standing up for right. Had Reuben stood up to his brothers and protected Joseph, the lad would never have been mistreated and be sold as a slave. Which brings us to a lesson about God. Where was he in all of this? There is no mention. We don't hear that from the pit he prayed as Jonah did at his lowest. And had Joseph never gone through this pit and to Egypt, how would his later statement that we looked at the beginning, that you intended this for harm, but God intended it for good, to save many lives, ever be made? That's a hard one. I think the answer lies in the dreams. Remember that in this age of patriarchs, God's revelation of himself was still very early. The love of God had to be worked out by each person. But paradoxically, that's still how he works. Paul says, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, Philippians 2 and 12. But we have the advantage. We have so much more revelation, and we have the demonstration of his Son who came and lived among us. We, like Reuben, are accountable. He for his brother, we for our own salvation first, and then those of our brother and our sister and our neighbor. Dreams come from a creative imagination. We're going to see that Joseph has a cunning and creative mind. God imagined the world into existence out of nothing. God is once again imagining a people that will carry his message to the world. He'd promised that to Abraham, and now he was creating the means. This Joseph story ends with Joseph being the object, while the brothers pull all the strings. Next time, we'll see Joseph rise from the pit and new clothes of a better time, because in fact, it's not the brothers pulling the strings, but it's God working through history.